May I please the court? I'm Beth Fenson, and I represent the appellants, the Taylors, Alan Taylor and Linnell Taylor. This case is really a straightforward.
Just tilt the microphone.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
A little short.
Great.
Okay. This case is really a straightforward application of the express terms of the Truth in Lending Act, and as recently affirmed or explained by a unanimous Supreme Court in Jesenoski. The issues arose from the rescission provision of the Truth in Lending Act, which are set forth in the Act, and then there's case law that there's a step one, and step one is the rescission. When you send a letter, that's the rescission, and it happens by operation of law, and that's what my client did, and that's what we pled.
Well,
yes.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, you're assuming that the letter that was sent was in fact effective, but right. under our decision in Miguel, how was it? Wasn't it sent to the wrong party?
It was sent to both parties. It was sent to a trustee who then got it within the timely, within the three-year extended period.
Yeah, put aside the three-year.
I agree.
The district court was wrong on that. But right. I think under Miguel, though,
uh-huh.
it was not sent to the party that it needed to be sent to.
To
right?
the party it needed. The facts, and maybe they weren't. Maybe they weren't pleaded correctly, but the facts were that he sent...
No. We have the letter.
Yeah,
I can look at who it was addressed
to.
Yeah,
who it was addressed to, but then it was also sent... He faxed it to Deutsche Bank, to the trustee. The one that went to Bosco was an attorney who was under the Deed of Trust Act, acting as trustee under the Deed of Trust, and was supposed to be a neutral, you know, between the borrower on the Deed of Trust and the beneficiary. And so he... He did send it to that client, to Deutsche Bank.
Wait.
Bosco sent it to Deutsche Bank.
Yeah, I'm not talking about...
Yeah.
I'm talking about your client.
My client.
The only people they sent it to was this lawyer for the party representing the trustee, right?
Right.
And I'm
but
asking,
he also represented... He's also an attorney representing
Deutsche Bank. But I'm asking
Deutsche
under
Bank.
Miguel,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's Bosco?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just asking, under Miguel,
mm-hmm.
we had a somewhat similar situation.
Right.
We said, no, that doesn't count. You have to
That's
send it to
enough.
The bank.
That's not good enough. Yeah, it has to get to them. But I don't think in Miguel did it get to the beneficiary, because this one did. It was sent to Bosco and then sent to Deutsche. I mean, they had it timely. So I don't know if that makes a difference in your thinking about the facts of that rescission, but that's what happened. And then another one was sent, you know, within the statutory period as well. So...
Say the last part again.
Another one was also sent. Another letter was sent a month later. The September 2008 letter was the one that, you know, this is notice of rescission and followed all the statutory requirements. But then there was another one sent in October to
whom?
To the, all the parties, to Deutsche, because by then there was a bankruptcy, and I think that they had appeared and that he knew where to send it, because this was a consumer sending it on his own, you know.
Well, would you explain why this wasn't all settled in
what?
The modification agreement?
With the modification?
Yeah.
Because the circumstances were such that we have a consumer who's under fire, he is in bankruptcy, and he is trying to do anything he can do to save his home. And you have a servicer, you have an agent for Deutsche Bank, who's supposed to be the real beneficiary, who's saying, well, we'll do this for you and make this work for now. But he never said, well, I waive my rescission rights. It doesn't
but
say
your,
it. There's
your
no
position. It was duress. Is that what?
I don't think
you know, it's supposed to encourage this to happen in a bankruptcy is to settle this.
Well,
out
yeah,
to
settle. Yeah, to, as a yeah, yeah, but not in a way that. The Truth in Lending Act, and there's some case law about this. It's pretty specific about how you can't just easily waive your rights, because it's a consumer protection statute, and it's we have to read it in that flavor, and it's designed to protect consumers who may not know the boilerplate of what all they're signing, and it even says that you cannot waive your rights after the fact, especially. Without using this very specific language and under very specific terms, you can do it, but it's at closing of the loan, and it has to contain certain language, and so public policy doesn't encourage waiving, especially inadvertent waiving of those rights, I would say.
Yeah, in the loan modification agreement? Is that
correct, right. And in fact,
so
at that
time... The debtor goes into bankruptcy and they modify the loan? And you're saying that under the Truth in Lending Act, they can't do that?
I'm saying they can't waive their rescission rights if they've exercised them effectively. The statute is pretty, you know, straightforward, and I think that was Scalia's bent with it in Jasinoski. I mean, it just says what it says. It is sort of draconian in that sense in favor of the consumer, where ordinarily we see, you know, statutes of limitations have harsh application. It may, you know. But the lender has to do something. They can't just get this letter of rescission and do nothing.
Isn't that treated as a rejection?
It can be treated as rejection, but then that would put, again, the onus back on the borrower, which I don't think the statute reads that way, to have to go to court. It's supposed to be the lender. It's supposed to happen by operational law. That much is clear. And then the lender can say, we don't accept this, and they can take it to court. And that's how the statute reads.
I thought the statute gave them a certain amount of time to respond.
It gives the bank a certain amount of time to go to court and say, we want to reorder the steps 2 and 3. It's called an equitable reordering, and they can do that. They can do that, but what they can't do is just nothing and just act like it didn't occur, because it did, under Jasinoski and under the plain language of the statute.
Yeah, but I guess let me just follow up on Judge Schroeder's question, because so let's say that you as the borrower have decided at time one that it's in my interest to rescind this. I just want to unwind the whole transaction.
Right.
I'll give back, you know,
right,
the money or whatever.
Yeah.
But at time two, before everything in fact has been unwound, you decide, you know what, actually it's not in my interest now to do that. I'm content to just basically renegotiate the terms of the loan. And
right,
if the bank will give me that, then I'll forget about this rescission thing, right?
Right?
You're not saying that that's an option that's unavailable, are you?
No, that's available.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then why isn't that exactly what happened here?
Why that's what happened here?
Yeah.
Why not? Why isn't?
Because that was in his intent. Like, that was never his intent to waive his rights and to waive that rescission.
Well, I'm not sure the intent is here, neither here nor there.
And nothing in the contract, but I know, so we have to read the contract that he signed, and nothing in it says that we're undoing the rescission or that this is, different.
How could the loan be rescinded?
It doesn't treat it, you know, it doesn't treat that topic. And it should have, and actually it's drafted by the bank, you know, it's presented by the bank. The terms are pretty much adhesion, you know, and that's
no,
what
they're not.
In.
Your client could have said, no thanks, didn't you get my rescission notice, and I'm insisting upon unwinding
right.
this whole transaction. Instead, what your client did was negotiate more favorable terms on the loan and avoid the foreclosure sale.
Well, yeah, they weren't really, they added almost $100,000 to principal. They weren't really favorable terms on the loan, but yeah.
Well, the principal was added, but the rate went down.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it was like $281,000 loan, and they added $100,000 to it, so that's pretty substantial.
Well, they had the house for quite a period of time.
Yeah, they've lived there for 30 years. It's their family home.
Are they still in the house?
No. They lost the house. We asked for stay relief. We asked that the trustee sale not occur, and we moved the trial court and here for emergency relief and was denied.
And so when did they lose the house? When did they move out?
Christmas. But again, and following the flavor of the previous argument, is that this was a 12B6 motion. It was about sufficiency of the pleadings. And we pled how the notice was deficient. And we pled that they didn't receive two copies in a form they could take home. And that should have been enough to state a claim. Then the defendants attached extrinsic evidence of this acknowledgement that my clients didn't have a copy of. The judge in the order thought they had one copy. They had no copies. They'd never seen it. So we objected to that because it should have been Rule 56. It should have been turned into a summary judgment motion if they're going to attach extrinsic evidence that's not contemplated by the pleadings. It was an improper dismissal for sufficiency of the pleadings because there were enough facts there, and it met the Iqbal Twombly standard.
So the rescission happened, the rescission that you're referring to
mm-hmm.
happened in 2007?
2008.
And the lawsuit was filed in 2016?
Yes.
How is the statute not run no matter what?
No matter what? It was because it ran, but it didn't run on my client's rights, and it didn't run on step one. It became the bank could no longer go to court and seek an equitable reordering. The bank could no longer challenge it because that was the onus was after step one, which is what the consumer does by the plain terms of the statute. It was the onus was on the bank to do something. And again, indeed, I've had those cases where a bank will contest a decision and they'll come in and want a declaratory judgment that it didn't occur because this, the Truth in Lending Act is, it has that automatic, that powerful remedy for borrowers.
But they were in the house.
So if the time ran, yeah, then they were paying, too, under the loan modification.
Right, it hadn't been rescinded.
Right. But they did a vile rescission. The bank didn't do what it was supposed to do on its side. And so the burden and the failure shouldn't fall on the consumer who did properly exercise his rights.
Want to save some time for rebuttal,
yeah, sure.
Maybe?
I will.
Okay, let's hear from the bank's lawyer.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Kelly Dove, and I represent Deutsche Bank in this action. I think some of Your Honors' questions get to the heart of what's going on here. The purported
rescission.
Would you
explain?
Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt the flow of
Please.
Your argument, but I just did. Would you explain how a rescission is supposed to work in your view?
Well, I think there's two different ways it can work. One way is the consumer reaches out to the lender and says, I am exercising my intent to rescind, and the lender may recognize that it had some failure under TILA and accept the rescission. And in that circumstance, the rescission does in fact happen by operation of law because the parties have agreed about the TILA violation.
Here there was a notice of rescission. Let's assume it went to the right place eventually. There was not any response from the lender, right?
There was not direct response from the lender. I want to...
The effect of that.
Well, I want to respect the conditions of your question, but also point out that the letters that purported to exercise the right to rescind did both go to Tiffany and Bosco. They're on the face of the document. They say via, and they do say Deutsche Bank at the top and say via Tiffany and Bosco. And there is no record evidence demonstrating that there was any rescission sent to Deutsche Bank. Tiffany and Bosco did write back on October 6th was one of those letters and said, are you alleging that we failed or that the lender failed to give you copies, or are you alleging that you did not execute the document? There was not a response exactly to that letter. And then again on October 21st, 2008, Mr. Taylor sent another letter to Tiffany and Bosco that was what he titled a qualified written request, asking a series of questions and again noting his intent to rescind. So under Miguel, we think that is not effective. Where in Miguel, it held it could not go to just an agent of the lender. It had
well, just,
to go
just
to
respect
bank.
The terms
sure.
of my question now for a minute.
So what was the
go,
lender?
If it did
so,
go to the right place,
if it did
then
go
whose burden was it to do something at that point?
Ultimately, the borrowers. So under the statute, the lender has 20 days to come forward and say, yes, we accept your rescission or take some other action. But if the lender doesn't take an action or does not cancel under the rescission, the borrower has 1 year from that time under 1640E, and as Miguel recognized, to take some action against the borrower to enforce
but,
the rescission.
No, wait. It's the borrower has to take some action against the lender or the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's just in some kind of legal purgatory, and the cases abound with that being the way it happens. I mean, this court has recognized that in Merritt, a case cited by appellants, Yamamoto, McComey, which is a case that has since been partially overruled by the Jezanowski decision. But this is what typically happens, is if a lender says, no, we don't accept your rescission, we did not have a TILA violation, the borrower brings suit against the lender to enforce the rescission and has 1 year from the refusal to cancel to do that.
And it's the same effect, it's the same burden whether they respond or whether they don't.
Yes. I don't have any specific authority for that. But if the lender says no, the borrower has to take some action to enforce its rescission. And here, the borrower, by any number of measures, just took no such action for many, many years. I mean, even though there was no prompt response directly from Deutsche Bank to the letters that were sent within the three-year period, but incorrectly to Tiffany and Bosco, Mr. Taylor later sent a letter to the servicer, to ASC, in early 2009, to which ASC responded explicitly by a letter of February 6, 2009, and said, your extended right to rescind has expired. We're not going along with this. If you take that one-year statute of limitations from 1640E and you apply it to any number of events, whether it's the February 6, 2009 letter from ASC, whether it's the bankruptcy proceedings where the lender explicitly via its servicer moved to lift the stay in also in January 2009, whether it's the recordation of the cancellation of Mr. Taylor's, you know, self-recorded deed of reconveyance, by any measure, their 2016 lawsuit is very, very untimely. And that's not taking into account the fact that they later entered the loan modification agreement, which reaffirmed their obligations, although modified, and though it did add some principal to the loan in the amount of, I think, closer to $54,000 because it incorporated all of the overdue and past interest and missed payments, it lowered the interest rate from a variable rate between that fluctuated between 7 and 14% down to 4% and made the loan fixed as opposed to variable. There's no waiver, and there's no waiver of a right to a TILA claim in the loan modification agreement. We're simply arguing that by virtue of entering the agreement, they have negotiated this agreement, which gets rid of the fact, any fact that they might have previously argued about rescission. The cases that appellants cite that have to do with waiver are cases in which a loan modification agreement includes an explicit waiver of causes of action. Here, at the time they entered the loan modification in 2010, there were no pending causes of action. Appellants had never brought a TILA claim. The lender never asked them to waive a TILA claim, or there's just no waiver in there at all. It's just the fact of their entering the agreement undercuts any claim they have about rescission. And I'd be happy to address the false recording issue if Your Honors have any questions about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
I would just like to clarify, opposing counsel said that 1640E somehow places the burden back on the borrower. It doesn't say that. That's not what the statute says. You can look for that. That's not there. It doesn't say which party acts next.
What it says is that you as the borrower have 1 year within which to bring any action predicated on a violation of the provisions of the statute.
I think, though, that is false. They've done something, which Jesenowski tells us. They've done something, and it has a legal effect. They have started something that then the bank is the only party that can feasibly go and say, we want an equitable reordering of the steps for paying back, because that's what the bank generally does under the Truth in Lending Act. They'll go to court to get a declaratory judgment and see how much is owed, because you're going to have to unwind the thing. And I'm saying now, yeah, that's time barred. They can't unwind it anymore.
No. But
the step one still happened.
Okay, I grant you that. So, right, let's assume that the notice was properly sent, that it triggered the bank. I think the bank is given, 20 days in which to...
Supposed to do something.
Okay, got it. So they don't do anything.
Right.
You as the borrower are sitting there saying, hey, my loan should have been rescinded at this point.
Right.
Why doesn't the 1640E say you have a year after that 20 days expires and the bank has done nothing to basically put into effect the rescission that you've
asked for? The rescission?
Yeah, you have a year in which to go after them in court. And if you don't, then why isn't your action
timed? There's no way of understanding what the status of the...
Well, I think the 1 year does apply for other, you know, truth and... The rescission is a separate remedy, and it's a special deal in the statute. But there are lots of little, you know, truth in lending violations that you would have a year to sue. And so I think that I don't know that... when the statute has a specific order, and our Supreme Court has just said, yes, it really does mean what it says, step one is the borrowers, then the statute does not say the borrower retains all burdens to make sure that this occurs. In fact, you know, in practical application, it happens otherwise. A lot of banks ignored it, but they shouldn't. I mean, that's the purpose of the act is consumer protection, and I don't think we should encourage the banks to just ignore people and say, no, you know, this it didn't occur. When we have a statute and Jasinowski that says it did.
But otherwise, you can show up 25 years later and say, hey, remember that notice I sent you?
No, you can't, because you can't unwind it anymore. But what we're just saying is the rescission happened, and what's the effect of that? The rescission happened by operation of law, and what's the effect of that? Yeah, you know.
Well,
But it wasn't the borrower that slept on its rights. It was the bank, because they needed to do something affirmative. If this is operation of law, and that is what Jasinowski clearly says, I mean, three times, you know, so why does the onus fall on the borrower?
And you stayed in-house.
Mm-hmm. But anyway,
okay.
Any questions?
Okay. Okay, thank you. Case just argued will be submitted. Appreciate the arguments. We will move to the last case on the calendar, which is Tony versus Young.